Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrat Richard Boykin, Amisha Cross, Charles Lipson, and Mike Miller. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8029. That's 1-800-723-8029. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com. Well, of course, we will be talking tonight about the shutdown, what it means, Obamacare, how many people have signed up, the difficulty people have had in signing up. And I want to begin with something that Richard Boykin, who returns, one of our Democrats this evening, and the former chief of staff to Illinois Congressman Danny Davis. You said right before we went on the air that you think that Boehner's days as speaker are over because of his conduct just last week or beyond that? Well, or is he a man with no control?
I think he's just a man with no control. I mean, he doesn't have any control of his caucus. He has 40 to 50 members of his caucus who are far to the right who basically said, hey, we're going to bring the government down. We're going to bring the government to a total shutdown. I mean, if Boehner brought to the floor a clean CR, he could pass that clean CR with Democratic votes and moderate Republicans.
Mike Miller of DePaul University, do you think Boehner's days are numbered, and would that be good insofar as you're concerned?
I think they could look for some new leadership, but I do wonder that I think Boehner was willing to negotiate, and he's taken a harder line, and I think the Republicans are going to line up behind him.
Amisha Cross joins us as well. I know you're not a big John Boehner fan, but
I will say, in agreement with the previous speaker, the Republicans may line up behind him. The Republicans may. The Tea Party won't. And I think that's one of the major problems that he's actually had this whole time. He's not able to build a coalition among his base. He's not able to get consensus, and that's driving him into the ground.
Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago.
I don't think any leader would have support within the two factions of that caucus, really. So it's possible that the Tea Party might try to veto him, but I don't see anybody who could have solved the problem that he was faced with, frankly, on the Republican side.
What happens next, Richard Boykin? Well, you said last week on this program you think that you thought the Republicans would ultimately cave. Do you still stand by that?
Oh, there's no question about it, because we have a deadline of October 17th when the government actually runs out of money and we can't pay our bills. And so what happens is
Let me just stop for a second. You say the government runs out of money. We've been hearing for the last couple of weeks, and certainly for the last week, that the government is going to shut down. And yet this department stays open, this department stays over. We know the national parks are closed. And then we've also learned that some of the federal employees who have been furloughed this last week, a bill was passed that they're ultimately going to get paid again.
That's correct.
They're getting paid vacations. So if I'm a taxpayer and I'm an American saying, okay, where is evidence that the government is really shut down? And how do I know on October 18th that the government can't really pay its bills?
Well,
what does it mean?
I think that the shutdown is real. I mean, you ask people who are receiving WIC subsidies, women, infant, and children subsidies, they're not getting them anymore. You ask folks who we have fewer inspectors who are inspecting different meat products and that sort of thing through the USDA. I mean, I think it's seen at different levels of the government, and certainly if you're one of those individuals, you're impacted. The other thing is that a lot of folks who do business with different agencies, they're impacted as well. And so I think that to really gamble, if you will, or throw the dice and suggest that, well, this government can afford to run the risk of actually having a default on our credit is a bad thing to do.
You're an economist, so let's look at it from the role of an economist. Mm-hmm. What's really going on here, and how important is that debt ceiling, and how important is that vote?
Okay, I'll work to the debt ceiling. The damage of the shutdown is going to be minimal itself. The damage has already been done to the economy by what's going on in the uncertainty over the fiscal policy of the United States. The research that economists have been doing shows that unemployment would be one full percentage point lower if we didn't have this uncertainty. On top of that, you have a president who's more concerned about income redistribution than he is economic growth. To have redistribution, you must have growth. So the problem is we've already had all the damage. The damage that will come from this shutdown is going to be minimal. 80% of the government's still working.
Right.
The government's still collecting our tax dollars. There's only a few dollars not going out.
What happens on October 17th?
I don't understand.
Are the bills still going to be paid?
Yes, the bills are going to be there and money's going to be coming in, but there will be certain bills that can't be paid because they can't borrow new money.
Right.
But under the laws of the United States, the debt must be paid. Now, people, just because we're actually paying the debt, people might lose faith in the fact that we're going to pay them.
Well, there's
no question.
But the
very first thing that all these billions that are coming in, they're going to pay the debt first. They're going to pay the principal to make sure that nobody defaults. But that means Social Security might not get the money, and that could then begin to hurt.
Amisha.
My comment goes towards yours in regards to income redistribution. I don't think that that's the president's plan. I think that part of his plan is making sure that each American has an equal chance at getting a slice of the American dream, getting a slice of the pie, because that's what we have here as Americans. And for a long time, certain groups of Americans have been denied that right.
Charles Lipson.
Oh, no.
The issue about defaulting on our debt is really bogus. And the reason it's bogus is because we have a lot of money coming in. It's just that we don't have enough to pay all the bills. But the first bills... So then the question becomes, which bills get priority? Paying the debt would be one. But make no mistake, if the United States didn't raise its debt limit, that would be a serious political problem. And on that issue, I think the president will have to negotiate. And I think it was silly of the Republicans to focus on Obamacare and delaying that, which I think was a non-starter from the get-go. And they are now learning that on this issue, which he desperately needs to continue, they can get some concessions. The question is not to ask for too much. And the president is currently saying, I won't negotiate. That's an unsustainable position.
Richard.
I just obviously cannot believe that my colleagues are sitting here advocating a policy to not pay our debts.
That's not what we said.
Or advocating a policy not to raise the debt ceiling. Look, in this country,
I did not say that. I did not. You're misrepresenting.
Okay, okay. Well,
what I said.
Let me say. I thought that's what I heard, but let me say that in this country, each president who's had to have the debt ceiling raised has never had to fight like President Obama to get that debt ceiling raised. There is no question.
Has any president ever had the debt ceiling raised without negotiations? Answer to that, I'll answer my own question. No.
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 It's just not true. But I didn't advocate. I was making an analytic point. I was saying I think the position is unsustainable because he, as the president, will ultimately be held responsible. I think right now they're playing both sides are playing a dangerous political game. I think right now the Democrats think they're winning, and I think they're right about that. But I think as they move closer to the moment where the debt ceiling is reached, that becomes a more serious problem because he's the president of the United States.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. Your assessment of the first week of the government shutdown, your reaction to it, and again, what you want your congressman to do, stand fast with the Republicans or support the president. 1-800-723-8289. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We will go to calls in just a moment. But, Charles, during the break, you were making the point about Wall Street and how Wall Street has reacted to this and their relationship alleged with the Republican Party.
I think it's interesting. Wall Street has not gone down. We were talking during the break, and Wall Street, the market hadn't gone down very much. Right now, the risk premium in bonds is not all that high. But by the same token, I think what you're seeing is the traditional split in the Republican Party between Wall Street and Main Street. The people who are really on the Tea Party side of this are real Main Street types, clearly on the right. And I'm certainly not saying all Main Street is there. But if you ask people in big banks, if you ask people at Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase, those people would say, just clear this out. Just send this through.
Let me say this, that there were a couple of days when Wall Street actually had gone down over 150 points, a couple of days, but they had this big meeting at the White House, and Speaker Boehner came out and said that we will absolutely not default. We will raise that debt ceiling. I'll bring a bill to the floor and depend on Democrats to pass it. You know, I mean, I think it's the right thing to do for him. But I'll also say this. There are a number of moderate Republican voices, Tom Cole, Pete King, a number of them who've actually come forward and said that tying the budget to the Affordable Care Act and defunding of the Affordable Care Act is a bad idea. It should have never been done. It's a bad strategy to do it that way. And they know it's hurting the Republican Party. But more importantly, it's hurting the American people.
I want to find out from you, Amisha, because you are with enrollamerica.org. One of your roles is to, you're supposed to be enrolling people in Obamacare. First of all, address the issue, which got a great deal of publicity, and everybody talked about it on all the Sunday shows today, and that is the website. The fact that the government, with all this buildup, really blew it. And for those people who have great concern about the government's ability to do anything right and giving them yet another huge opportunity to invade our lives, the website doesn't work, or it doesn't work properly.
What a lead-in to that question. The website not working is one of the hugest glitches. I think that the White House, the full administration, HHS, everybody can admit that that was a huge issue.
Well, it's good that they would admit it, because it would be pretty hard to deny it.
At this point, yesterday, the website was actually down for half of the day while they had IT people working the entire day to get everything straight. Because first day of enrollment, several people had to go on three or four times to get through certain questions.
So here's my question. If I am an American and I'm concerned about one more government program now invading me, invading my life, invasive in my life, literally and maybe figuratively, why should I have confidence if they can't even get the organization straight? Why would they have confidence that that program is going to be well managed and something that is going to be good for them in the long run?
Well, I think that confidence is built by understanding, one, that it's needed, two, that there are a lot of partners and organizations that are working with the federal government to make sure that this goes out unhinged, and three, because right now it's working at full capacity. There has to be an understanding that when you're looking at a group of people in the hundreds of thousands who are uninsured, and a lot of them logged on at the same time to a site, any site would have that same responsibility in regards to shutting down.
All right, the private sector, websites. Drudge Report, what, gets a billion a day? They get a billion hits a day. They have to have that kind of server ability. And it's my understanding.
Their health insurance is really poor, though. If you go to Drudge and you try to sign up for health insurance,
it'd be really,
nothing.
It would be bad. But you also have the situation. A member of my family tried to get on, couldn't even get past the front thing. A couple days later, couldn't get past the front gate. And there's also the question, which we're in my family we're concerned about. There's no guarantee that the encryption is up to snuff. There's no guarantee that any information he puts out there is going to stay there as opposed to be hacked. What do you do when all the stuff, your Social Security number, all your private information could go out there?
How big a problem is this with the American people?
It's a big problem, because your initial rollout, you'd like to have success stories, and in fact what you're hearing is mess-up stories. It seems to me that there's a larger lesson here, which is, imagine if you'd rolled this program out a month ago in three states, relatively small states, and gotten the glitches out that way. Instead, this is the way our government does it. And let me just say, if we had built high-rise public housing in four cities and just waited a few years, we would have never built it all the way across the country in every city and then had to tear it down. So the fact is, we just rolled out a huge program all at once, no beta testing, and all the questions you raise come up. They're legitimate.
Amisha.
They are legitimate questions. I will say, I guess coming from a generation that's younger, I'm used to programs having glitches. If you've ever bought a new iPhone, hey, iPhones have glitches. I think that, again, a lot of those things have been addressed.
But you're not necessarily the generation that would be fearful of providing all this information, as we've just talked about. The generation is a little bit older. But again, you would hope that with all the talk and all the discussion that all of these issues would have been worked out in advance, that someone would have known that maybe, you know, maybe 3 million people were going to get on the website at the same time.
I agree with you on that. I think that there was a gross underestimation of how many people would utilize it.
And the question but is yet, not whether yeah. it's a glitch in the iPhone. It's whether it's going to be like those iPhone maps that send you to the end of a runway at an airport.
Richard Boykin.
I just,
government program, not well thought out, well-intentioned, but maybe not well thought out.
Three years.
Look, let me just say this, that there is no perfect program. There is always going to be some glitches, but what you do is you work to make it better. And so I think that what the administration is doing is they're working to make it better. I think that the wrinkles will get ironed out in this program, and I think what you'll have in the end is you'll have millions of people who otherwise would not have health care coverage covered under a system, and that is a good thing for America.
That's not what is necessary. What is necessary is for a bunch of people who don't really need insurance signing up and being forced to pay so that the people who can't get insurance can get insurance.
I would like to know
the whole thing is based upon healthy people paying premiums for which they won't use the services so that the people who can't get insurance under any other system get the insurance. This creates.
The question is whether all that backlog was people with pre-existing yeah. conditions who will cost a lot to cover. I should also say there's another big issue. Remember, it was promised around the issue of 30-plus million people not having insurance and needing it. If what we're told after all this drama is that there are 6 million or 7 million additional, leaving us with 23 or 30 million still uninsured, people are going to ask why the whole portion of the economy was upended for a relatively modest result.
I also wanted to point out, though, Bruce, because you mentioned earlier about this federal government shutdown and the fact that you know, you aren't seeing signs of it. It's not really weighing heavy on our economy. But I think it is, Professor. I think you just don't see it. People aren't getting paid. And so they're not going out and they're not spending. So that is an effect on the economy. The other thing is that cybersecurity individuals, officers, have been laid off. They've been furloughed. And so we're susceptible to attack. I mean, our cybersecurity. And so that is a big issue relative to the shutdown, and God only knows what will happen. I hope we don't have any attacks. Because
let's go to Greg in South Bend, Indiana, listening to us on WLS. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Here's the one issue that nobody's addressing. The fact that when a law is written by the legislative, the president has no right to change any part of it. And he's changed 15 parts of it, but nobody wants to discuss that. And my question is why? You don't have the right to change a law once it's written.
All right, let's let the
I completely agree with you. When the president first did this and changed, he was going to give these 1-year delays to various waivers to people. I went into my colleagues and said, can the president just, is he king? Can he just change the law at his will, at his whim? And of course, we all say no. And I was outraged. And I think one of the times I was on the show, I was outraged, but there was no other outrage. No one seems to care.
And there's one other point to this. When the Supreme Court told them how to change the law,
he rewrote it.
The Supreme Court does not have the right to make decisions like that. It's either legal or not legal. They do not have the power to make legislation. That is what the House and the Senate's for. Therefore, it should have never been allowed from that point. I don't understand why every Republican and Democrat, whether it's a good law or not, is irrelevant. The fact is it didn't follow our Constitution. If we're not going to follow our Constitution, then why are we even discussing anything? Mm-hmm. And somebody said, well, we're shutting down the country. And the world is looking at us. The world's looking at us because they're proud that we're standing up for what's right. And we have a democracy. It's not a dictatorship.
I think that this is the authentic voice of people mm-hmm. on the right, and especially in the Tea Party, who think that this government is becoming increasingly lawless. Let me say one thing on the other side of it. These very complicated laws are not just written with every I dotted and T crossed that the president is supposed to implement. And the details of this law are sufficiently complex, and sufficient amounts of it have been delegated to the president and HHS to implement in their own way, that I can't tell you on this provision or that provision whether the law actually gave the president the authority to change it. But that in itself is a problem.
Our phone number, 1-800-723-8029. More callers taking America's political pulse from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce DeWine. Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. That time of my broadcast where we ask each of our guests to introduce themselves. We begin with Richard Boykin.
Hi, Bruce. I'm Richard Boykin. Thank you for having me on the show again. I'm a partner at Barnes & Thornburg, also radio host of Bridge Builders Radio, WCGO 1590 AM.
Also with us is Charles Lipson.
Bruce, I've been on here for years and years and years, and
probably about 25 years.
25 years. I started as a mere ute. I'm a professor at the University of Chicago. I teach international politics, and I love doing Beyond the Beltway precisely because we get calls from all over the country.
Amisha Cross.
I'm Amisha Cross, Miss Black Chicago 2013. I work with Enroll America and the Cook County government.
And you're a big Obama supporter.
And I'm a big Obama supporter, also worked in the White House.
I'm Mike Miller. I'm an economist at DePaul University, and I'm proof that there actually are a couple of Republicans in academia.
Let's go to Elizabeth, listening to us in New York City. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Hi. My name is Elizabeth.
Can you speak up a little bit louder, please?
Yes. I'm just calling because I do think that there has to be something to defund Obamacare. Once this outrageously enormous program gets implemented, I don't know how it's going to be sustainable. I mean, it's something that Congress has already voted to opt out of, which I find is fairly outrageous, that if they are going to cram this down the American people's throat, they should also be enforced to
Elizabeth, let me just interrupt. This call is very muffled. I think I understand your question, but again, we're going to move on. But I think the bottom line to her question is she believes that the health care law is unsustainable. So let's talk about – I'll let you start, Professor.
Sure.
What is the price tag on this program?
Oh, it's $1 trillion over 10 years, $1.1 trillion, which would be $110 billion a year. And a lot of it is supposed to be paid for by people who are healthy signing up because they have to, or otherwise they have to pay a tax, not a fine, which is what it was originally. In addition to that, there are going to be all these savings in Medicare. And I understand that some of those people in what is called Medicare Advantage have all of a sudden realized that all of this is coming out of their hide.
So and these who are has people. To sign up? Everybody's got to
everybody
sign
has,
up.
Everybody has to
even
prove to the IRS.
Even if you're on Medicare.
Medicare is accepted because you're over 65. So anybody less than 65.
Okay. So I want to agree with that and add one point. So the key point is that there are some people who previously couldn't get insurance. They had a heart condition or whatever. They're not going to be able to be covered. But that's very expensive. So who's going to pay for that? Either it's going to be the general taxpayer, and that's not what the Obama program was really about. Therefore, it has to be young, healthy people mm-hmm. signing up and paying, in effect, more for their insurance so they can cover a 65-year-old who needs a heart operation. There's a second issue, and that is a lot of people were told, if you like your current insurance, your current doctor, you can keep it. that's only true if your current insurance meets all the new regulations. And a lot of people are finding that their employer, rather than beef up their insurance so that it covered all the new conditions that were mandated, has said, no, I think I'll drop insurance entirely. And those people are going to have to go into the pool.
Now, do you agree, Richard, that, again, a lot of companies have decided, opted out of the program, and they're throwing their employees off the medical benefits they have?
I haven't seen the evidence of that. I mean, I just haven't seen evidence of that.
It's in the papers every week.
Well,
Do you ignore that it's happening? Do you not?
Not at all.
I mean, the stories about Home Depot and other companies laying, you know, just saying that they're not going to be doing it anymore, forcing people into a series of part-time positions because they don't want to be obligated to carry that stuff. I mean, are you saying that's not happening?
I'm saying that I don't know how widespread that is. I have not seen that being widespread. I've heard that. I've read some of that. But I don't think that's wholesale.
It is at Walgreens right here in Chicago area. They've 160,000 have been moved off of their basic plan, and they said, we're going to give you money, we're going to help you, but you're going to go to the exchanges. We're not going to do it anymore. And Home Depot, like you mentioned.
But they're still going to have health insurance, right, Professor?
They're going to have insurance.
And so what's wrong with that?
It's not going to be the same program. It's not going to be the same
doctors. But they're going to have health insurance. I mean, they're not throwing them off their health insurance.
But remember, the problem
was...
That wasn't
what we were promised.
But wait.
They're going to have health insurance.
Are they going to have health insurance, or will they be uninsured?
No, wait a minute. Let's say I have a Lexus, and I'm promised that I can keep this Lexus, and as soon as it's all over, I get a Kia. And you tell me, well, you still have a car, so don't tell me that this is not an issue here, that you have a Kia.
You can only drive it 50 miles a week.
Lots of people are going to be in this program, are going to go out of programs where they had particular doctors or particular programs, and now they're going to go into ones where they aren't, that they have to stay within certain hospitals and certain doctors. They're not going to have their old doctor.
I want to get Misha into this, because you're dealing with people trying to get them to sign up. What questions are they asking you when they sign up?
Most of the people who I'm working with who are interested in signing up are people who don't already have health insurance. Mm-hmm. There are some who are also coming to the exchanges to find out if there is a better plan out there than what they're already paying. In a lot of cases, people pay more with their employer than they probably would if they go in into actual, like, Obamacare. Then it's going to be easier for them to manage their other expenses in regards to what they're already paying with where they're at. And it's open to people who are part-time
workers.
That raises
a big issue. Will they save money?
We're going to go to calls. Tom in Naples, Florida, listening to us on XM Satellite Radio tonight. Go ahead.
I am a hard, cold fact to prove that this Obamacare is a disaster. In the state of Florida, I logged onto that joke system of to get Obamacare. My wife is a GM retired employee. I'm a spouse, also retired. Unfortunately, I'm age 55. Now, through her program, I was able to get an okay program. $5,000 a year deductible, and my cost was $5,000 a year. Under this great, glorious new program, under this Obamacare program, my cost to keep similar coverage will go from $5,000 to $15,000 a year. Hey, and guess how many companies are available for insuring me in Collier County, Florida? One. Now, what kind of competition is that? Have any of you people logged on to this system and tried to plug into your own numbers? No. And if you say yes, you're lying. This is an utter disaster.
Have you plugged into your own programs, Amisha?
I have. To answer his question, though, I will say that largely one of the interesting points about Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act is that a lot of its provisions are state dependent. So when you're looking at someplace like Florida, a lot of their organizations have opted out of actually having a legitimate marketplace for people to come and look for and compare different healthcare plans.
Why would they do that? There are some things
in Florida that are not consistent across the nation.
So why would they do that? Why would healthcare people who want to provide health care, insure, that's how they make money, they insure people, or they're companies that deliver the care. Why aren't they in the system, Amisha?
What am I supposed to do? Wait a minute. What am I supposed to do?
Go ahead, Tom.
What am I supposed to do now? This is going from my out-of-pocket, $5,000 a year to $15,000 a year. I can't afford that. What do I do?
Yeah, you're exactly right. There's another provision. If you take a married couple with no children, and they make roughly $30,000 each, which totals to $60,000, the amount of subsidy will make their annual premium about $5,000. They make $100 more and pushes them over this one limit. They all of a sudden have to pay $15,000.
Now, Tom, I'm going to ask you a follow-up question, because it's a question that I think people in the audience might want to ask you. Okay? So don't, if your blood pressure goes up, I'm asking this question for them. But what they might say is, okay, Tom is calling from Naples, Florida. He's 55 and he's retired, and his wife is a former GM executive. Can't they afford $15,000 for their insurance as opposed to just $5,000?
No. We live in a very, very modest home, okay? We rent. We don't own, okay? I chose to get out of Illinois for one reason. Taxes were destroying me. My property taxes in 10 years in suburban Naperville, I'm sorry, in 20 years, went from $2,500 to $9,000 a year. It was crushing me, okay? I'm going to have to go back to work. I thought I could live. I thought I could sustain the rest of my life, my wife and I living very modestly with 6 and 8 year and 10-year-old cars, but I can't do it anymore now. I also have bad knees. I can't work anymore. But I'm not going to go on this damn disability like all these other scumbags that I see around this country. But you know what? I'm being forced to go on disability. Now, what other options do I have? And I still haven't heard an answer. My old system was okay. It wasn't great, but it was good. I am furious.
Richard, let's let Richard respond. Let's let Richard respond.
No, look, I have sympathy and compassion for the gentleman from Florida.
But you have no defense. You know, I don't want any damn sympathy. I want answers, and I'm not getting it.
There is one.
I tried to call these people in Washington. I tried to call my congressman, who's wonderful, but he just says, "I'm sorry. This is what we're stuck with now."
Yeah, I heard a discussion today with regard to the Illinois law, and you're asking part about there is no competition that would lead me to have this very high price that I have to pay for this health care. One thing that is required under the law with Obamacare is only a certain percentage of the actual money that goes to the company can be used to operate the company. All the rest has to be paid out in the form of service to the people. There are many small companies that cannot make it on the amount which is allowed by this law, and therefore in states where this exists, they simply have left. And therefore in Illinois, we have many fewer companies to choose from because this law has been imposed.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. Tom, good luck and hang in there. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Well, Misha, you wanted to make a point to Tom, who was calling from Naples, Florida, because you wanted to point where the finger should be pointed.
My point to Tom from Naples was basically that Florida is an exception in a lot of ways, because the Florida governor and the Florida legislature opted out of a lot of provisions to Obamacare themselves. And they've also run commercials showing companies these erroneous statements about what would happen to them if they actually took part in it, what would happen to their employees. And they basically ran their own campaign against it and decided from get-go that they just weren't going to be a part of it.
And if they had run it just like President Obama wanted, would Tom not have had these problems?
I don't believe Tom would have had these problems, no. Not the ones that he mentioned in that call.
Okay. Let's go to Brian, listening to us in Indianapolis, Indiana. You have a different perspective on Obamacare.
Well, I love your topic tonight. Very informational. Also informational is World Health Organization's top 40 list, where America ranks 37 out of 40 in the world for health care. The top 10 countries, France, Italy, Israel, Japan, Austria, they all have a national universal health plan. I believe that the problem with health care in America, and so do physicians, refer a national health plan, pnhp.org or madashelldoctors.com. Let's do it like the top 10 countries in the world do it. I think the problem with healthcare in America, well, running America's healthcare system through Wall Street might be a pretty good indication that there's a problem. And when you rank 37 out of 40 in the world for healthcare,
Mike Miller's got a comment for you, Brian.
One thing about that particular kind of ranking, I'm not sure it's this exact ranking. It turns out that if you take out of the U.S. data the health care related to automobile accidents, which happen at a larger percentage in many other countries, and murder, the gunshot wounds and so forth, that the places where there's actually health care, just like Bruce had his health problems and so forth, when you look at those kinds of health matters, the United States is at the top. We're not at the bottom. It's because
well,
we deal with so many severe cases that people
Street,
die.
Don't you think you're asking for trouble?
Well, you take something like...
Let's run America's health care through Bernie Madoff. How's that going to work for the American people?
But Brian, you talk about your concern about running.
Well, my particular situation is pretty.
But what about running it through? As we
yeah,
talked
the only
before,
option.
What
for
about
me
running? What about running it through a government that does not do a lot of things not very well?
Promoting the general welfare of the people is a constitutional duty of the government. The government haters out there, we need to know that's in the Constitution. And the top 10, why don't we do it like the top 10 countries
let
in the world
explain.
Rather than 37?
You made your point. Let's let Charles respond. We're going to give you, or you're going to get two professors for the price of one.
What's wrong with this kind of argument, and it's wrong with many kinds of arguments like this, is A, there's a problem. B, I can imagine a perfect solution. C, that perfect solution is the government. Point proved. Well, it's not proved. What people have been calling in and saying is this is a real program run by this government, and people are fearful that it's going to work with the same kind of efficiency and consumer-friendly quality that the Department of Motor Vehicles has. If you don't like the Department of Motor Vehicles, you can get your Illinois driver's license from nowhere else.
Charles in Joliet, Illinois. Go ahead. You're on the air. Member of the Tea Party, I understand.
Well, I'm a supporter of the Tea Party. Sorry. I have three points to make. One, I'm not a politician, so I can say this. It's not the government's job to provide health care for us. That's not in the government's purview. They should not be in the business of providing health care for us. Two, we have $17 trillion in debt. Why are we taking on another entitlement program? We can't afford the programs that we have
well,
right
let,
now.
Let's let Richard respond to that, just on the issue of the debt.
Well, look, I understand the debt, but this health care plan and program is important because too many people are becoming bankrupt over the fact that they have health care issues. And so,
what about the country becoming bankrupt?
Well, the country's not going to become bankrupt because what we got to do is we got to get the country working again. We got to get people working. We got to get more people paying taxes into the system. We got to,
you got to take more taxes from people who have been successful.
No, we got to create more jobs. We got to create more jobs.
And how's that going?
How's it going?
Not well.
Look, I think it's moving at the pace of a tortoise. But what I will say is this, is that to do nothing about 40-plus million Americans who have no health care is not a good solution either because taxpayers wind up footing the bill
but
at emergency
should you
rooms.
Care more about the 260 million people more than you do the 40 million?
I care about all of them.
Well, I know.
I care about all the
American
citizens.
It's nice to say that, but the reality is the people who are the earners and are the producers, I mean, they're feeling that why are we expanding and creating a new government program when we're already, as the caller suggested, we're already in debt? Why do it now?
I don't know. We have these same kind of debates about Social Security, which is one of the best government programs ever created. That we have the same debate about Medicare, which was one of the best government programs ever invented and created. In fact, when you talk about folks trying to take and roll back Social Security or privatize it, people stand up in arms and say, absolutely not.
Charles,
no
what
changes
about it historically? Is he right?
The fact is,
there weren't talk shows at that point, so there were people who talk like this. Talk about
if you remember those 1930s, we've decided that people who really need health care will get it. And right now they're getting it through emergency rooms. This is a terrible way to do it. We need to solve the problem of the people who have pre-existing conditions and people who are not insured. The real question is whether this particular program at this particular cost will work well. The issue is not dealing with all those people, but how best to deal with them.
We are out of time at that particular point. Our thanks to Amisha Cross and Richard Boykin and Charles Lipson and Mike Miller for being with us in hour number one. They will be back for hour number two. If you're listening to this program on radio, we have another full hour. And in the next hour, we're going to be talking about foreign affairs. We're going to be moving on to other subjects in the next hour. So if you're standing by talking about health care, we're out of time for you tonight. But again, stay on the line because we're going to be talking about other issues. Until then, don't go away. If you're watching us or listening to us on radio, if you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Richard Boykin, Amisha Cross, Charles Lipson, and Mike Miller. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com. Well, in this hour of the broadcast, I want to talk a little bit about foreign affairs. We'll also get back into some internal issues that deal with American health, not specifically Obamacare, but the broader issue of mental health in America. We're going to talk about that in this portion of our show as well, and the criminal justice system. But Charles, I want to begin with you. Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago joins us, because for the last couple of weeks on this program, certainly last week on this program, we spent a great deal of time talking about the new leadership in Iran and the phone call between the president and the new leader of Iran and the new foreign minister of Iran, who was on television last week. I think one of the best performances, I think, of a foreign leader to speaking to the American audience that I've seen in a long time, you know, acknowledging that the Holocaust did happen. And the Israelis and critics have referred to it as a charm offensive by Iran. And then Prime Minister Netanyahu comes to the United States this week, and he's presenting a different perspective. As an American Jew who is very concerned about the Middle East, do you take the new look and the new sound of Iran and its leadership seriously?
I think it needs to be explored, but I'm quite skeptical. That is, the main leader in Iran is not the people we see. The main leader is Khamenei. Yeah. He's out of the public eye. I do think they're under considerable pressure because of the economic sanctions. I don't think that the American threat to use military action is credible in Tehran or in Qom. That is, I don't think that they believe it. Certainly a lot of Americans don't believe it. The Israelis no longer believe it. So one arm is tied behind our back, and I think having that threat is perhaps the best way to avoid having to use it. But what they would like to do is one of two things, I think. I think they would like to continue to delay things during negotiations, and I think they would be willing to strike a partial deal if they could get almost all the sanctions lifted.
Richard Boykin joins us, former chief of staff for Congressman Danny Davis, Democrat of Illinois. Do you believe Iran? I mean, is there a new day, or is there a danger that the president might be seduced and the American people might be seduced because Iran really wants to buy more time and build up their nuclear capability?
Look, I think we should always give diplomacy an opportunity to work, but I'm kind of like Reagan, trust but verify. And so I think we stand with Israel, which is one of our most reliable allies in the region.
But you probably wouldn't trust either, would you? You said trust but verify, but I suspect you'd be more skeptical than just trusting, wouldn't you?
Well, I think we got to see. We got to go in. I think somebody suggested send inspectors in right
away.
Well,
they said they would be open to quick inspection. Sure. Mike Miller of DePaul.
I'm going to tell a real quick story, and it has a punchline. Being professors, we're often evaluated by students, and our pay raises can be affected by it, and our promotion and so forth. And one thing we always have students tell us is whether or not they think that we know what we're talking about. So there was a study done one time where they brought in an actor and made it pretend like he was an economist, and they gave him a script. And at the end, they asked, did this guy really know his economics? And they all wrote down, absolutely yes. The man was just blowing smoke. He had no idea what he was saying. But he said it so well, and I think that what we're seeing in Iran is exactly that. They're blowing smoke. They are simply pacing and waiting time and trying to distract us as they continue to develop the bomb.
But we can't wave away their offer.
No, we can't
negotiate.
Wave it away. But
Amesha Cross, your reaction.
I agree with Dr. Lipson a lot on this one. I feel like we do have to wait and see. We cannot, and I think that they're pushing for, hopeful, that we will lift all sanctions. That is their biggest bargaining tool. So at this point, and based on our history with Iran, I would not go full-fledged believing that everything that they say is actually going to happen. One, because, again, their leadership is the Ayatollah, and we have heard absolutely nothing from him or his minions. It's been very quiet on that level. And we, again, have a history with them that isn't exactly great. So
we have the North Korea problem. That is, we struck a deal with them, and we saw that that deal ultimately broke down because they cheated on it and cheated on it behind our backs. So we don't want to go down that road. They've worked very closely, by the way, with North Korea. We don't want to go down that road.
I wonder, Charles, if you could maybe speak to it. My concern would be that Israel, in looking at this, recognizes they don't have an ally here. We're not going to do anything. Could this not, if we start buying this line that they're giving us, couldn't this lead Israel to move sooner rather than later?
I think that Israel's calculations are very complex, and I certainly can't speak for them. I spoke with Israeli officials literally this morning in person about some of these issues. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that across the Middle East, American allies, and here I would talk about Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and so forth, have been really shocked by the erratic quality of American policy. Mm-hmm. They were really stunned by how quickly we abandoned Mubarak, how we seem to be backing the Muslim Brotherhood. Then we've backed out of that. Nobody really knows what our policies are. It's not just that, and they've been very confused in Syria. So I think a lot of people are thinking American policy is not being run with a kind of steady hand, and the attempt to project a military threat seems very ineffective.
Let's put it in context with the other things that the Obama administration has been doing with some degree of success, mm-hmm. and that is the ongoing assault on the war on terror. I mean, they're picking off some pretty big targets. They had a very great weekend with the ability of the military following up on it. I mean, that's a constant pressure. So I think one of the signals is that if you mess with the United States, you are going to pay a price.
Well, I think that what you're saying, there's no question, but these were remarkable achievements.
It may not be the ultimate price, but you will suffer.
These are remarkable achievements, and there's one other achievement. It looks like in Tunisia, the Islamists have been pushed out of the government, and that's very good. But the key to a lot of this is actually in Egypt. If we don't have a stable government in Egypt, it's going to be very hard to stabilize the region, and it looks as if we have no options that look reasonable in Syria anymore. It looks like either side that wins is an anti-American, and not just anti-American, but a real challenge and threat to the United States.
Mike, do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely, that case. And the one country I'm familiar with is a small one, is Bahrain. And in that situation there, the king, I think, feels left out by what has happened. There's no doubt that there's all this social strife in this little country, but the people that are uprising are Shia, and you just know that the country will be worse off if Shia got into power. But the president's not showing any strength in backing
it's
the king.
It's not just the president. America wants to come home. After these two big wars, there's just no thirst for doing much that involves boots on the ground. So as long as you can
and
do
probably,
these things.
And probably never will be unless there's another direct attack
that's
on
right.
the homeland. That's not like that.
Well, the president is operating within these constraints.
We got to pause. 1-800-723-8290. When we come back, we're going to switch gears, but your calls are welcome at 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont, live from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, switching gears now, bringing up a subject that is, as you know, near and dear to my heart because we discuss it periodically. Usually, we discuss this subject in the wake of some mass shooting that has taken place in America because there is a mental health link to it. A couple of weeks ago, because of things in the world, we didn't really, actually, it was a week I was not here. There was the tragedy of the shooting in the Navy Yard. And one of the things I know Richard DeBoykin wanted to talk about, and that is as it relates not only to Obamacare, but the broader health of the country, and that is the way in which those who need mental health treatment are really basically ignored in many cases in this country.
That is right, Bruce. The greatness of a country is actually judged by how we treat our children, how we treat our elderly, and certainly how we treat the sick in our society. We've seen substantial cuts since 2009 to mental health services throughout the country. We've seen over $4.35 billion in cuts funding for mental health services. And I think this has left us a vulnerable nation in terms of these kinds of mass attacks. And people really need the help. And, you know, just to talk about a story that I encountered with Sheriff Tom Dart, the sheriff of Cook County, second largest county in the country. I toured the facility about a month ago.
Which facility?
Cook County Jail. 13,000 inmates there, overcrowding, and a lot of the people there are African-American males, young African-American males. But Tom Dart said to me that a third of the people should not be here, Richard. And I said, why not? He says, because they have mental health issues. And he said that they're basically getting their mental health treatment through Cook County Jail. And so I think it's a shame. I think we got to figure out a way to put more resources.
And with Obamacare, that doesn't deal with mental health-related issues.
It deals with mental health-related issues. What it does not do is create clinics within communities for mental health. And I actually attended a AMA conference today, and that was one of the things that was discussed. One in three people who visit the hospital across the United States have mental health issues, and a lot of those are not addressed because there are no community clinics. A lot of those are being shut down, and the capacity to actually house and host a lot of the mental health patients is not something that counties and states are actually
and
capable of.
And mental health generally is not covered in general insurance policies.
That's not quite true. There is coverage, but
substance
it's not.
Substance abuse cases.
Well, no, but it depends on your coverage. The University of Chicago student and faculty, you get to visit psychiatrists, psychologists, psychiatric social workers, but you often have limited payment and a limited number of sessions. This is a very serious issue. Amisha works for the Cook County officials who actually supervise the jail, and I'm wondering whether or not under the new healthcare law and other kinds of payments, whether or not there's going to be any relief for the county in terms of dealing with the problem that was just raised about a third of the people in the jail. Do you have any sense of what's going to happen?
Currently, we're working with the prison system as well as several clinicians to make sure that we're able to address that, at least on a macro scale, just because it's a lot larger than I think people realize. And in a lot of ways, it's a stigmatized issue. So people may or may not know that they have it. And some people who know that they have mental health issues also don't seek out the help. So it's us actually identifying those things before there is a major incident that lands someone in the Cook County Jail, as well as working with the governor and his leadership to make sure that there is state funding allotted for these clinicians.
Can I ask one more question? With all the shooting we hear about involved in a playground and that sort of thing, there must be a real impact on those children living in dangerous neighborhoods? What are we seeing about kids that are growing up in these environments? Are there really more serious mental health issues as a result of that?
What we're seeing is a greater level of depression, anxiety, and a greater level of anger management. And I can say that specifically because in addition to the work that I do with Cook County, I also work with students of incarcerated parents and children who have actually been victims of abuse and victims of neglect in terms of gang violence and other issues that happen within their family. So what we see is a pattern. If you are raised in that type of community, if you grew up seeing those things, there's a higher likelihood that you will have a certain level of mental health issues.
Mike Miller, I think you've been on the program when we've discussed some of these subjects in the past. From your view, what role does government and what role does non-government entities have in trying to address this issue of mental health, which isn't discussed very often except in the wake of horrible circumstances?
And that's
it's always a common denominator.
And it is a very pressing issue. And my fear, my worry, you were talking about stigma that attached to this. I think that one of the problems we're seeing is that once somebody says that I have a mental health issue, we put everybody into the box as though you're all schizophrenic, as though you're all going to be a danger to yourself. When 90 or 95% of people who have depression or something like that, there's not an issue there. But people are prepared to take away their Second Amendment rights, for example, because you might have a mental health issue. Well, yeah, you may be depressed. That doesn't mean you're going to go out and kill somebody. But there are these very severe cases that involve maybe a paranoid schizophrenia or whatever, where the state needs to step in. And, of course, that's where we have the problem, because we used to take these people and simply put them away. So and starting in the 60s, we don't. And now they're on the street. And now we see some of the cases where people,
again,
they
kill. But, again, that was another example in the 60s. Well-intentioned.
Yes, absolutely.
The intention was good, but the reality is that it's not good. And this was something that, again, this was one of the – Ted Kennedy was a leader in this movement, the deinstitutional movement, and it has led to homelessness in major cities, which is becoming a major problem in Chicago as well. And in some cases, there are violence. In some cases, they're two separate things. But, again, a vast majority, I would say, of the people who are homeless on the streets – have some degree of mental illness.
Severe. I mean, we're not talking about simply depression.
So one of the issues...
And there are different degrees of depression.
Of course.
Yeah, and also the other issue is obviously as it relates to violence, whether it leads to... mental health doesn't necessarily lead to antisocial violent behavior.
Exactly. But we have too few facilities.
But it frequently does.
We have too few facilities.
And those are the things we learn about.
Too few providers. We have inadequate insurance coverage.
Yes.
And it's the combination of those. And we have for people
and
who are
stigma.
More sufficient.
And the stigma.
Stigma's right. And we have for severely mentally ill people we have who might be a danger either to themselves or to others. We have increasingly made it hard to involuntarily commit them. And that is a danger to everybody. On a lot of these people, when we say there was a mental health issue, we need to take the additional step and say, if Dr. X saw this person, could she have committed him? And often the answer is no.
Bruce, can I ask the two professors if they would be willing to put additional resources towards mental health treatment?
I certainly would. But I would also say that in general on healthcare, one of the things that concerned me about the whole healthcare overhaul was the absence of putting new delivery systems in, adding personnel, adding nurses, nurse practitioners, doctors, a lot of that stuff. So we end up adding demand to an existing system without expanding it. I really would like to see that.
Well, I think, you know, this also brings up a point, Richard, and, you know, when you've been on the program before, again, you and I agree on a lot of issues. We disagree on some issues.
Not many.
Not that many.
Right.
I mean, because I think that the reality is we have to deal with priorities. I mean, it would be great to be able to say that there's mental health facilities in communities where people could go in and seek help, or they can seek it when, you know, from the school nurse who is trained in that particular area. But we also talked a couple of weeks ago when we were on the program, and that is about you rightfully so are engaged in trying to do something for those that are incarcerated,
right,
who are about to be released because you do not want them to come back. And the recidivist rate is at like 60%, at least at state prisons, a little less in the federal prisons. So it makes sense that if someone is going away to prison and they're not being treated in any way, and they come out and there are no jobs, which is a point you made over and over again, that who should get that job? Should a person who's created a crime be given any special attention ahead of someone that maybe hasn't committed any particular kind of crime? And it comes back to, how do you pay it? How do you prioritize? What do we not do? Who is not served? What government program is cut? So we can legitimately think in a common sense way about the expansion of mental health, which is a common denominator in many of the social ills, whether it's violence on the street, abuse of women, whatever the case may be. I mean, a lot of them go back to mental health. But where do you take the money from?
I think you have to look at the budget and figure out where you can get some
but
savings.
Where? Give us some examples. I mean and it can't just be the military. That's the quick answer, but it isn't exclusively the military.
You know, when I sat down and I talked to Tom Dart, I mean, and this is specific to Cook County, I mean, he said to me, Rich, we can save millions of dollars in Cook County if we move to video arraignment. In other words, he moves between 1,200 and 1,400 prisoners a day in and out of court systems. And so he says, they're doing it in Iowa, they're doing it all over the country. Video arraignment. He says, if we move to that, we'll save millions.
Well, who stops that from happening? Who stops that? Who also stops the common sense aspect of it? It is the 21st century. There are electronic monitoring that can be done of prisoners, so you know exactly where they are.
They can photograph they our can cars photogra-
they
for
can do,
tickets.
They can do all of that, but it is an alternative to incarceration, which makes common sense. But how do you get the attention of the politicians to act on that? Because it is saving money in many cases. That's the question for you, for everybody. When we come back, we'll take your calls. 1-800-723-8289. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. We're talking about a serious issue, but Charles Lipson, you just spilled water all over the table.
I blame you, Bruce. You made me laugh.
Introduce yourself to the audience. Charles Lipson, we're going to start with you.
I'm Charles Lipson, a professor at the University of Chicago, originally from Mississippi, like Amisha, my friend here.
Marks, Mississippi.
And I was saying that my wife is a mental health professional, and Bruce said, was she a mental health professional before she met me? And that's what had me knock over my water.
Amisha, go to you.
Okay, I'm Amisha Cross, Miss Black Chicago, and I'm also with Enroll America and Cook County Government.
And Mike Miller.
And I'm Mike Miller. I'm an economist at DePaul University, originally from Pittsburgh. And I was back in Pennsylvania this weekend for a wedding, and the state looks beautiful. Trees are changing.
Oh, yeah,
the roads weave and bob. Oh, it's just wonderful.
And let's go to Richard Boykin.
Well, I'm pleased to be here, Bruce. Maybe this is the first time you've had three Mississippians on your show.
I didn't know you were from
Jackson.
Really? And where, Amisha, where are you from?
Brandon.
Just outside of Jackson.
Yeah. So, I mean,
Oh,
and I got relatives there, but I'm a partner at Barnes and Thornburg and former chief of staff to Congressman Danny Davis and radio talk show host.
Very good. We're going to go to, we're going to go to calls because then I'm going to ask another question. Let's go to Brian, who identifies himself as a police officer. And I guess you deal with the mentally ill from time to time, officer.
More than time to time. I actually run our crisis intervention team unit as a national program, so we go. We're specifically dispatched to mental illness calls because we are extra trained in dealing with it.
And what observation can you make about the treatment that you can provide, and the role that mental health could play, maybe in solving some of the social ills we have in the country?
I mean, mental health is one of the biggest problems that we have. You look at a lot of these tragic situations, and they roots right back to it. And Illinois, I mean, I'm from Central Illinois. Illinois as a state is horrible. They pull money from corrections. They pull money from Health and Human Services. Corrections usually gets the money back because people, you know, don't want to let criminals go walking around. But Health and Human Services never gets the money back. And like one of your panel members talked to Sheriff Bart, the three largest mental institutions in the United States of America is the L.A. County Jail, the Cook County Jail, and Rikers Island in New York. How much intelligence does it take to figure out that there's something wrong with that?
How do we get a focus on that? I'm going to go back. Thanks very much for your call. How do we get a focus on that? Because it's, you know, it's the squeaky wheel gets the oil. But with the exception of these incidents that happen three or four times a year, it becomes a story for about 10 days. And then usually the bigger, broader story is about gun control. And gun control may be a portion of the problem. But the bigger problem is mental health.
Bruce, I think that you're talking about it, and folks who are concerned about it, they're listening. And obviously, I think it has to be a grassroots kind of movement that basically says, hey, look, we got to put more focus and attention on this issue. And I also think that the president at some point needs to use the bully pulpit. I mean, the situation with the lady who got killed outside of the Capitol, mm-hmm. With the baby in the car.
Right.
She was suffering from postpartum depression, mental illness. And, you know, maybe
Navy,
that could have
the
been
Navy
avoided.
Yard, the Navy Yard.
The Navy Yard incident.
When you say
well.
that we have to get people behind us, that's one of the real difficulties here, right? When you talk about guns, there's an active group of people mm-hmm. who would like to reduce them. There's an active people on the other side. In the case of mental health, there's nobody on the other side. The problem is that there's nobody who's – there's not a really active group of people. There's another place where stigma might matter. There used to be a stigma about talking about things like breast cancer because it had the word breast. We've gotten over that, right? Prostate cancer the same way. We need to get over – this stigma so that we can begin to organize and begin to have these kinds of marches for adequate services. And it would be a great thing for the president, for the first lady, for others to begin to advocate for.
Well, it would be great if we could have someone that had that, because the closest thing to an advocate at the national level, and he's no longer a senator, was Pete Domenici, the longtime senator from New Mexico, who had suffered mental illness in his family, and that's generally the case. If you've gone through that, you know the devastation that it can have on a family, and you can see the understanding on it. And likewise, you know, insofar as the issues of incarceration, the America's jails and prisons and federal prisons, they are filled with people who do not receive adequate psychological training or testing assessments while they're there. And in many cases, you know, they have to wait to get back on the street to make another mistake, and then they go back in again. But so it's a systemic problem that is not being addressed when you look at all the problems that we have in the country.
I don't want to be the fly in the ointment here, but no. Richard, I understand. So let's say we take a large number of these prisoners and we put them into the mental health as opposed to in prison, so to speak. What if the decision were made that they need to be held? They need to be because they have schizophrenia or paranoia or whatever, and a large percentage of them are black. Do you think there's going to be an uprising that this is just another way to push down the black man and keep him off the street? It happened with for example, stop and frisk in New York. It's going to go away because the people they were stopping and frisking we're black. See, one of the fears I have is either that if we do a lot and we start to put people away because they're a danger to themselves and to us, it could be used against somebody if it's misused by the state. They can take somebody who's not sick and put them away.
It was used in the Soviet Union.
Or the other concern, just to expand on that, is because in many cases it isn't just psychiatric treatment. There are drugs involved.
Yes.
There's pharmaceuticals that can improve and make life livable for people with mental illness.
If they take them.
If they take them. But again, we would then be talking about, at least as, again, talking about the racial makeup of the prison or the jail you're talking about.
Right.
Would there be this fear that the African American community was being treated in a pharmaceutical way,
right,
and that there would be resentment to that? Because there, in our history, there have been tests done on African Americans,
sure.
So there is there is a fear of that. But it is a way. I mean, these drugs are a way of controlling one's anger, controlling violence. But again, there are many people who I think can demagogue that issue.
Sure.
And it would be perceived by some as yet another government program or yet another conspiracy by the white man, let me be blunt here, to control black young men.
Well, let me respond to Professor Miller, because I think he raises, and you, Bruce, a good point. But I think the reality of it is that we have to do something.
We're all in agreement on that.
These folks, and Sheriff Dart said this. He said, "Rich, they're a danger to my guards. Mm-hmm. My guards can't deal with these guys. They're not adequately equipped to deal with them. In fact, they have behavioral issues that we haven't seen as guards."
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have to do, I think, is we have to communicate. We have to move together with the community, the leaders in the community. Explain what we're doing, why we're doing it.
Is that an issue?
Because it's the right thing to do.
Is there more of a stigma in I just don't know what kind of a stigma different communities treat these kinds of issues differently. Can you give me some sense of how mental health issues are perceived in the same kind of communities? Well, I'm not talking about the whole black community, but the kind of communities that are filling up our jails, which are sort of people with less education, lower class, a lot of violence, not very good family structures. Is admitting you have a mental health issue something that people readily do, don't do, is stigmatized? Okay. What?
No, and I think Amisha said it earlier. I think it's a stigma issue to admit that you have a mental health issue. I mean, it's like Bruce asked you the question, about, your wife. Was she in mental health before she married you or whatever? I'm just joking. Or did she get into it afterwards? No. And I think it's a stigma issue. And I think, but you got to communicate. I think the church leaders, the faith-based community, I think the NAACP and others have to begin to communicate these issues. These are real issues, and they affect all of us in America.
I feel like there's definitely a greater stigma in the African American community when it comes to mental health issues. One, automatically, even in the name, mental health issues is attached to the mind. And when even if we go back to Darwinic theory, as an African American, the idea was your brain capacity, your mental capacity is lower because of your race. So if you're talking to people about mental health issues and there is a connection to their intelligence level, which a lot of people make, regardless of what that mental health issue happens to be, and maybe it's something that African Americans intuitively make on their own. Maybe it's not projected by anybody else, but it is something that I've heard several times when talking to the community about mental health.
So it's somehow equated with being stupid or...
Yes, and not being able to function
naturally.
And then
others were saying was it could be perceived as external control. And when people think about people not like you trying to control your mind, that's very dangerous.
Right.
And the idea that it's a funnel down from a single parent household or from growing up in poverty, so now we extrapolate it on the whole, this whole population might have a mental health issue. I grew up in a single parent household. I grew up with my mom having food stamps, welfare, and everything else. I don't have any mental health issues. So I think that it can be offensive sometimes. It depends on the framing of how you actually post it to a population of people.
But it does have to be addressed. 1-800-723-8020. And we have callers on the line. They want to talk about this subject. We will hear from them when we continue from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dubois. Bruce Dubois back in Chicago. Let's go to Darren, listening to us in Rochelle, Illinois on WLS. Go ahead, Darren.
Hi. I'd just like to say that I've been in the mental health system my entire life, and it's not as bad as people think it is. There's a lot of wonderful things that go on. People help you find out what it is that you enjoy and what you're good at. And I'll tell you, I've made something in my life. I've realized that drugs and cheating and all that is not right. And the things I've done, I've managed to be very proud of myself. I've met a lot of nice people, done a lot of nice things.
How did you first realize that you needed help?
It was obvious. I couldn't think for myself. I had no direction in life. I'd stay in bed countless days, and I was just, you know, a sight to see.
So you were diagnosed with some kind of depression?
Yes, I have schizophrenic and bipolar, and I had a drug psychosis, but I whipped all of it. I gave up drugs years and years ago, and that spurred me on a lot. And I've done all these self-help groups, and the one thing I can tell you that's more important than anything is responsible participation and self-expression. If you put those together, you'll smile proud at some point.
And if we could wave a magic wand right now and say to you, Darren, that you could be the mental health czar of the country, what would be the first thing you would want a program to focus on?
Someone would have to support you, a family member, a friend, even a worker, but someone close to you has to be supportive to you. It's very important to have someone that believes in you.
That's so important. That's so important to the resolution of virtually every.
But it's why this whole point about stigma is important. We think of the stigma as relating only to the person who might have the illness won't go in and tell somebody that she has having a problem. But if it's a stigma so that your mother, your brother, your close friends don't want to support you, you're afraid of telling them, then, yeah.
Let's go to Elizabeth. Elizabeth, I understand that you have a family member who has mental illness.
Oh, yes, I do. I have a brother with severe paranoia. And I'm a caller prior to us, but unfortunately, he's probably a very rare case. And for families like mine, to hear Tom Dart talk about mental health and the people in jail that have mental illness, I'm happy to hear that. But I am very fearful that he is going to release them onto the street because Illinois is not set up to support these people, nor do the laws protect families like mine where forced medication would be wonderful because the laws are such that they can go unmedicated. And they can have such a wonderful quality of life if they can be on medication. And I'm only talking about now severe mental illness. I'm not talking about general depression or drug addiction, but like severe bipolarity and paranoid schizophrenia, which affects my family.
Right.
Those are my general comments. It would be effective and efficient if we could get some laws regarding forced treatment for those who are unable to stick to medicinal regimen.
All right, Rich.
Thank you.
That's a tough piece of legislation to get passed.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. But the county jail is not a place for people to get treatment for mental health services. The county jail is ill-equipped to do that. And you can't hold people in county jail for years and years and years.
Should public school systems take a more aggressive role? I mean, is that where... as opposed to the local hospital, I mean, should the focus be on something else, another responsibility that happens when you walk into a school? Not a classroom. You go to a classroom to learn, but it seems to me that a common denominator is to walk into a school, and in that school, that's where the totality of a young person's life has got to be focused. And if part of that problem is they need assistance or a friend or to deal with that, it seems to me that that's the first place where that should happen.
Which means
that's where the increased expertise, the increased psychological training and personnel needs to be.
Yeah, but Bruce, I think that one of the things that we have to be cautious of there is that a lot of African American males have been grouped as special ed in these school systems.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not special ed. I mean, but once they get labeled as special ed, then, of course, all sorts of other things attached to them that may be negative, and they may begin to act out as if they're special ed.
But there's got to be some testing that would indicate whether someone is legitimately special ed or someone is just acting antisocial.
Well, but even in antisocial, in many cases, again, that's the fly in the ointment. You always worry, just like with Ritalin and so forth, that the state can force a family to put a child on. Maybe the child's just a boy. Maybe he's a rambunctious boy.
I want
we
to
don't
say,
let that happen
Fresno,
anymore.
California, you're on the air, it's KMJ.
This is what they do.
Good evening.
And we've got about a minute, Joe.
You know, real quickly, this gal, Miriam Carey, that was shot on Capitol Hill is a tragedy. But I just pose a question to you folks. Had she survived, she would have been charged with attempted murder, probably of the two people that she injured and might have killed. But we wouldn't have had a dialogue about changing car ownership or banning cars. But certainly, had she used a gun to do it, we would have been talking about what? More control on rightful legal ownership of guns. And I just want to pose that question out there to make people rethink that there is a degree of individual responsibility that has to be considered here. Unfortunately, she was clearly mentally ill. And I completely agree that we need to make these resources available for folks who have this illness and for families to have a resource to go to.
Joe, I wish we could talk more. You make a good point. It's at the end of our broadcast this evening, but thank you for your call. Thanks to Amisha Cross for being with us, Richard Boykin, Charles Lipson, Mike Miller, all for being with us this week on Beyond the Beltway. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.